Welcome to Free Bird Seed. We are talking today with Michael Bissell about APIs. And I think, Michael, the thing that caught my attention, I saw you on LinkedIn talking about a concept called API First. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. It's funny. The concept of first is like, there's a lot of firsts. There's API first, there's code first, there's what's the other one? Cloud first, you know, and I think a lot of that comes from, well, what I do, whoever I am, I think my piece of the tech puzzle is the most important part. But really the battle between API first and code first came out of more architectural design. So API contracts are an artifact. They're you build out that just the what you're going to build as a, you know, again, an architectural design, and then you give it to the engineer who will then build the software, as opposed to code first, where you go into something like your Java Spring, start scaffolding out something, and then it dumps out the contract. And so, you know, there's been this tug of war. Do you design it first, or do you just sit down and in the kind of an agile model, get moving with that? And what I posted on LinkedIn was, you know, it's not either of those. Where we need to start is, and what I said was identity first, but it really is customer first. And it really is that outside in view, because how can you design something, whether you're scaffolding it in code or whether you're building a contract, if you don't know who you're building it for, if you don't know what sort of restrictions you're going to put on it? I'm going to have these different collections in the API. Some of them are administrative, some of them are public, some of them are user specific. You need to know those things to define the identity, but you need to understand who that is. Yeah, so it's the who comes first. Then you can get to the what. And whether you're scaffolding it or building the contract, depends on how much beer I've had and what bar I'm in for how I'm going to argue that one. As far as I'm concerned, at that point, you're talking about tooling, not really design.
That's interesting to me. Absolutely, because I'm going to pick a nugget out of all the stuff that you said there. I personally think that there are a couple of different sort of ways that people approach agile development, and the customer first mindset is really the key story there that often gets overlooked, because people get really kind of obsessed about, you know, what are the tools and techniques that we can put in place to help us do this better? And one of the things that comes out of that is very often code first as an emergent property of the things that people talk about and think about and do when they're doing agile. One of the reasons for that are partly historical, I think, because there was such a long period of time, decades in our industry, where we were wrapped around the axle of defining everything and documenting all those requirements first. But I think the most important part of the agile mindset is to think about the customer first with respect to everything. So I love the fact that those are the two pieces that you sort of like elevate.
Well, but this is one of the challenges that I see with agile right now is that the idea that we're delivery first, you know, the idea that, and this is the problem in tech right now, where you're talking about corporate tech, where you're talking about, we've hired a huge team to deliver something. We need metrics on that. Code first works really well for that, because you can talk about what you delivered in that sprint. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's harder to go to things like, well, personas. Okay. You delivered descriptions of three or four different personas. Well, that's still not what I mean by defining the who. I mean, it's really stepping outside of the agile process and really, before you even decide to hire that huge tech team to put them into a management process, you have to really know who your customers are, what you're building, and what your actual business purpose is. Because all of that, then you can start plugging into these ceremonies that we do in the agile world. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't really thought about it that way, you know, that it's kind of like strategy first, but
all of this stuff is so complicated. There's so many layers of abstraction involved that the people who were in the room together and wrote the Agile Manifesto have substantial disagreements about what it means. And that's only like, you know, 12 statements.
I think of Agile as being kind of a Buddhist religion. You know, Buddhism is one of these things. It's a very adaptive religion, and it's very different in China than from Japan than India. You know, it sort of works its way into a culture, and you know, there's some core tenets in that religious framework, just like there is in Agile. You know, and different companies should be actually doing things a little bit differently. It's all about, again, what are we trying to build and how do we get there? And you got to remember that Agile, of course, was not designed as an end-all project management framework. It was originally for prototyping. So it's for a short period of time, we're going to keep iterating through until we get something that we can give to the sales team that they can go run with. Which I'm assuming that if we got an Agile person on here, they you know, three different Agile leads, experts, they would all have a different opinion on that too.
Well, and I have a different opinion too, but it doesn't, I mean, I think there's plenty of room in this for lots of different opinions about how it's done. Obviously there is, because there are entirely different sort of method, you know, documented methodologies for how to take the Agile principles and apply them in your craft.
Right.
And if you look at those, they, you know, some of them are wildly different, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
So with the API first idea, which is, you know, which is sort of like new to me, I guess I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about what part of what thing goes first, because from my perspective, it's always been customer first is kind of the automatic assumption. Because I'm in consulting, it always winds up being that way. Like, it kind of has to. Like, there isn't any way out of it. But when you're in a big organization, which I have been in the past, it's sometimes you forget about who the customer is, because your team might actually be building something for another team inside the organization, not for an external customer. And that makes those relationships kind of fuzzier and harder to define. And
the customer's held hostage in that situation. You know, you have a very, you are my customer, whether you want to be or not, kind of relationship on an internal project. And again, there are those goals, but you still bringing it up to just application, regardless of defining, you know, things like Agile, defining things like interdepartmental issues for who's a customer. When developing an application in general, I've broken it down into the who, what, where. I got it out of order. I hate it when I do that. The who, what, how, and where. And the when is just 24/7. Let's just take the when as a given that we want as good of uptime as we want. But the who is that first step, again, defining your consumers. And your consumers, then this is one of the things that we also forget. We were talking about personas, and we're talking about people. In the API world, so much about connecting system to system. So you're really talking about people and services, whether those services are the UI, or whether it's an IoT thing, or it's just another API that needs to connect, you know, some sort of connective way. So these things still need identity. They still need security. That this one thing, I mean, I always point to that big hack they had back about 10 years or so ago, where all the credit card machines got hacked, and it turned out that they got into Target's credit card systems by hacking the thermostat in the store, because it was on the same Wi-Fi network, which then allowed them on a trusted network to get to that point of sale system. That device should never have had permission to talk to the point of sale system. It should still have identity. It should still be, you know, defined. What does the thermostat get to talk to? You know, so those are things. If you have a service, you know, like a point of sale service, you should have very clear rules of who gets to do what where. And that in turn gets you to the what stage, which is what I was talking about with the contract design. you want to now define that contract and say, okay, what are the things that the who are going to connect to, whether it's people or services or things. You know, you need to understand, what is that point of sale path look like? Don't do it ad hoc. Think about it. Think about a way that you're going to be able to enforce it now that you know who's going to be connecting to it and what sort of data you're going to be pulling out of that. But then that leads you to the how, which is your gateways, your routers, your things like that, which now can be informed by those two previous steps. So this is pretty much design in the first two steps, which back to what we were talking about with Agile, and maybe it's code first because we want to be able to do deliverables. You know, that's all, everything I talk about in the first two of my four steps is abstract. It's design. It's thinking about what we're going to build. But when you have that designed so well at that point, it should be a simple matter of taking that contract and creating those router rules, you know, whether it's going to be like in an Apigee or any other kind of a gateway system, like an Envoy, even in Kubernetes, because now you know what resources you're hitting. You've got your methods and your paths. You've got your payloads defined. All of that's taken care of because you thought about what is going to be accessed by who. And then you've got all those rules for the who, which you can pull from an identity access management system, or you can, and you get it in the form of a, like a, an OIDC token in the JOT. So now here you have those two pieces that you can put together, do all that enforcement right there. And heck, for most of what we do in the API world, which is static data, the where on the back end could be an S3 bucket. It could be a simple database. It could be another API. It could be something like that. But now you're just talking about, okay, I've done all my enforcement and I'm relaying it to that back end. And so those last two steps should actually be fairly simple. We shouldn't be constantly reinventing the wheel or even creating these really kind of, I just find it interesting that in 2022, we're still creating purpose-built kind of data systems when what we really need is all those definitions of the who and the what. And then, you know, then just hook it up, which I know sounds naively simple.
Yeah, that's the chalkboard cart, you know, the classic chalkboard cartoon where the and all the equations occurs. And then the cloud in the middle. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but it isn't really a miracle because of that. It's an informed miracle, if you will, because again, once you understand identity, and that's why I say identity first, whether, you know, when you're building those personas for those customers and those administrators and those different kinds of people, you know, we talk about them in personas in that agile world, but we really are defining, okay, how are different people going to, people and things, you know, going to connect to this, you know, we're going to want to be able to allow different kinds of services. Yet that information, I think that this is part of the problem, going back to that agile iterative design thing, is that you can't really just dive in completely blind. You can't just dive in and start. I mean, yeah, your first agile steps could be all of this design stage. It's not necessarily committing code, but it you know, we go in and we start writing code, and then we kind of figure out, okay, I've written this code, who's going to use it? And that's just so backwards, because then you start having these exceptions and you start getting breaches, and every day we still see breaches because we didn't really consider how we were going to restrict access to critical systems.
I was about to ask you a question that you kind of answered already. But I might ask it again anyway. Like, how often do you think that really happens? Like in my experience, even if it's not part of like a rigorous documented exercise, pretty much everybody involved is doing at least some amount of thinking when they're, even if they're, you know, even if they have this, you know, eager beaver dive in and start prototyping mindset, that they are doing that with the customer in mind, at least to some degree. Is it your contention that basically that just needs to be formalized a little bit better so that we can identify what the security relationships are earlier in the process? Or what is it that you're trying to uncover there?
Think about legacy systems. We deal with a lot of legacy systems. And something that I like to say is that legacy is not a dirty word. We don't have to throw away legacy systems. We've invested a lot into them. We have them built. But think about the projects that you've probably been involved with over time where you're pulled in because we have this legacy system. There's a company I worked for a while ago that we had a 15-year-old Windows server platform, no longer supported. How are we going to bring this up to date? How are we going to fix this? It became a very kind of DevSecOps kind of question. And the reality is, the way we solved it was, how are we going to fix the process, which was an onboarding process? It had to talk to this super old walnut in the middle of the machine, you know, the machine kind of thing. How do we remove the walnut, but really, what are the people and the process? And, you know, this was something that they were literally taking like weeks to onboard new customers. We went back to the beginning and started designing the interfaces and then looking at how we could connect to different systems and then still sort of protect that legacy system so that we could start redirecting new stuff to the new system and slowly moving them away, as opposed to what they had tried repeatedly, which is just, how do we upgrade this one core system? You know, they started, the problem they started with was, how do we upgrade the system? Not, how do we improve our process?
Yeah, that's interesting. A lot of times the reason that those core pieces haven't been updated in a long time in an organization is because back when it was originally built, the process that it was automating was broken and nobody thought about it. They didn't realize it was broken. Like if an onboarding process of a customer takes more than 3 seconds now in my world, in the mobile app world, you think about that. Yeah. There are onboarding processes that I've seen with, one of them is a major telephone company. I switched vendors. And the app for the new company that I switched to impressed me, and I've been building, leading teams and building mobile apps for a long time. Yeah. And it was so smooth and so much different than what the state of the art is for their competitors, that it really made me think about that. But if the process was invented 15 years ago and it worked 15 years ago, and it was something that people accepted, isn't necessarily true today.
That's true. Our customer expectations have definitely changed in the last 5 years. You know, just, I mean, honestly, so much of what we do today, you know, look at how much Zoom had to improve during COVID. You know, Zoom happened to be the leading app that became the default for everybody going home and working from home. They weren't ready for that. And, you know, our expectations immediately changed about security and being able to jump in there and who can access my meeting, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how we don't think about that now. We just assume that that Zoom's always been great. And it's like, you know, so that again, that constant improvement has to happen. You're absolutely right.
I've thought about Zoom a little bit, and I've only said anything about Zoom twice, and both times I had the same reaction, which really surprised me. Somebody was talking about Zoom and they mentioned something that they didn't really like about it, and then I mentioned the fact that I don't like it at all, and I still don't like it. I think it's gotten a lot better. But the feedback that I got was both of these people knew the guy that started it, and they both told me the same interesting thing. They said he actually wrote that app for himself. He didn't build it for other people. And that made it make a lot more sense to me. Like, oh, okay, if this is doing a certain set of things really well, and those were the things he needed at the time, and he turned it into a company, and it kind of grew maybe more than he thought.
Yeah, you get into that who section of that, and if it's and there's so much software like that. So much. I mean, I did a project eons ago where we were converting a .NET desktop application to a web application, and it was for a financial planner. And when my developers got into the code, the variables were all named things like A32. Because it turned out that it was originally an Excel spreadsheet. And those things
didn't see that coming forward
all the way into the desktop application, so to the point that the variables were named after the cell in the column. And that modernization gets hard when we talk about those legacy systems, where I say legacy is not a dirty word because we have things invested in it, but don't continue to bring your legacy expectations, like you're talking about, that 15 years ago was a very different customer expectation, or your coding practice. But this again goes to the facade, the idea that you can build your contract based on who's going to access it in a way that you can then create routing to, I don't want to say hide, but maybe I do want to say hide, but, you know, nobody should care what's going on behind the curtain. What they care about is whether they can pierce that curtain, you know, whether they can get through that and do things they shouldn't do, you know. And then, like I say, with the facade, you can start building new systems that support the current process with the current customer expectations and the current service integrations, and then start moving them over to the appropriate target.
Some of my geek friends that I've known for a long time, in the mid-90s, we would talk about how everything was a protocol. And if you think about it, in the programming world, it kind of is true. You know, it sort of, the protocols are implicit, though, sometimes, that they're embedded into the concept of the languages and into the design of the frameworks that you use. The framework itself is a protocol. These are APIs. Basically, everything is an API. And because we don't think about, as an industry and as people, we can't manage every layer of abstraction simultaneously all the time. So we work in the layer, we sort of work in a layer of abstraction where we're building our thing. You know, it's like you're using Swift and you're building a mobile app and you're using the Cocoa APIs, and then there's a microservice on the web that already exists. It was created by another team in the enterprise. The protocol we think about is the one that talks to the microservice. But if you're working with in a big organization, there can be dozens or hundreds of these legacy systems, like the one you were talking about earlier, right, that might have codified something in terms of a process that was true 40 or 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Like we don't think about this. These mainframes, the architecture of the service they're providing hasn't changed since the 60s in some cases.
Yeah, I noticed at one point doing some HIPAA work that the EDI standard they were using, which is, you know, the XML at the time, and now they keep evolving it. But the structure of it, the size of things, we realized, oh, this is based on punch cards.
Right.
This data structure is so legacy. But let me, you know, we could go way down that rabbit hole. But let me bring it back to the idea of decomposition of services. You know the phrase decomposition, where you take these individual, when I say API, I'm always referring to a RESTful API. You know, there are lots of different APIs. You're absolutely right. When I think API, I'm seeing JSON payloads being sent over HTTP, you know, to specific methods and resources. You know, it's to me, that helps create that facade I was talking about. That helps create that encapsulation. So you can have a microservice that's running in Node in a Docker container that's very scalable and very modern architecture. That you're hitting one endpoint for, that you have this, like, you know, like in a Kubernetes environment, like an Envoy gateway or something like that as a sidecar that's doing your enforcement and all that, right? If you're hitting it with HTTP and JSON payloads and basic, you know, your RV, your resource verb model, it doesn't matter whether what's behind there, that decomposed service, is really just one little service running in a Docker container, or it's a legacy AS400 system that's got visual basic translator, turning it into JSON to spit it out to make it look like that. What matters is your response times and your up times, mm-hmm. and whether you're creating choke points or not. And again, that's where you can start creating these translators, and you can start creating these different things to support your current, back to the identity first, you know, supporting your current customer expectations and security needs, and consumers, whether they're people or things. So, and I think that that's the hardest part, is that when I talk API, that whole idea of what do we mean by an API? It's like, I don't think it matters what we mean by an API. What matters is, can your consumers actually get to the information that they need, and can you secure it easily, and you're going to be able to manage it and replace it easily and move things. And you know, to me, it's like, yeah, you're right. Connecting to SQL on a native port is a programming interface of sorts, but it's certainly not.
Normally, you don't make that available on the on the wide woolly internet. But if you if you scanned it, you'd find more than one.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. So yeah, we're protected more by firewall rules now than by design. You know, if you spin up something on Amazon, like an EC2 instance, and put your classic LAMP stack on there, well, you're only going to open up port 80.443 and probably 22 if you want to get in there. But, you know, so you're not going to get to the SQL port there. It's all, you know, get a got on localhost. But what we forget is people get behind that firewall. People get inside. And once they're inside, now we're in the whole world of zero trust. And again, you need to be able to inform it all the way down to that level of service. I'm going to wrap my SQL in the same identity that I defined in the very first step of who, and I'm going to have a standard way. I'm using the open policy agent, the OPA rules, which is uses a language called Rego, or is it pronounced Rego? Because it's basically a regular expressions on steroids sort of framework. But
regular
that's a standard
expressions are already
now.
On steroids.
What's that?
Oh, regular yeah. expressions are already on steroids.
No, they're not on steroids. I think there are some other hallucinogens.
Other drugs.
Sometimes. Yeah. It's like, see the patterns, man, and it all comes right. out. But anyhow, my point following these standards to have some sort of, you know, going from the human side of it, you know, that same project I was talking about with that old legacy system, one of our actual requirements we put in the requirements document was that Deborah had to have fewer days she cried. We literally had somebody who was breaking down at her desk, and we just needed to make it better for her. And that's not a technical deliverable, you know, that's definitely one of your non-functional requirements, but it's a requirement.
It might have been the most important requirement on the whole project, honestly.
In my opinion, it actually was the most important one, because not only was it just for her, it was we as technologists, we in the world of automation should not be making anybody cry. We should be spreading joy and making them happy, or at least making them so unaware of what's going on that it doesn't affect them at all. You know? Mm-hmm. So
this person was a user of the product. Is that?
This was an internal system. So it was, she was in the department that handled all that onboarding. So
such an interesting thing. Like I have thought for a long time. I had a buddy who used to describe this in a fascinating way. He would say, his name is Tim. He would say that whenever he used a new piece of software that was written by anybody anywhere, he always found something that he knew shouldn't have ever got to the point where a customer was experiencing it.
Yeah.
And he said that what he thought needed to happen was that during the beta cycle before the product was released, the programmer needed to be put into a room with an actual user, mm-hmm. and he needed to have his hands handcuffed to the chair so he couldn't touch the keyboard and watch the user use the product.
I can't. Let me just do it for you. Oh, I can't.
Yeah.
That's clever. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's, again, that's one of the things that I've, with bugs and engineering issues over the years, I have frequently had to ask engineers to, what if you were the consumer of this? What if you were using this? Would you want to use this product if it keeps failing like this? Yeah, and it's funny how we forget that, because we get so into, yeah, but I can't. And I, you know, you get committed to your code. And again, that's identity first, as opposed to API first, as opposed to code first, you know, is that think about that customer experience. Think about what they're going to want to be able to do and how that's going to get to them. And it seems so obvious, like you said earlier. I mean, of course we're thinking about the customer, but you know, we're thinking about where we're going to go to lunch. We're thinking about, you know, why my processor keeps overclocking, which you may be hearing on the microphone. Yeah, it's like we're thinking about our day-to-day mundane stuff, and that's okay because we're human. But you know, when we have those daily ceremonies and like Scrum and things like that, we should have that, you know. We use the phrase North Star a lot, but we should have that thing that we're pointing towards, and we should have that context, and that context should always have that identity involved, because you can then frame every conversation about response times and access rules and onboarding and all of the different bits of delivery in the context of the person and their experience.
Michael, I'd like to thank you for your time. My impression is that we could talk about this for an hour once a week for a year and probably have an interesting conversation every time.
We could do the click and clack version of application development.
Yeah. Well, APIs are so interesting to me because I really do believe that everything is a protocol. I mean, one of the things that we used to joke about was what we call the double door protocol. So if you're going into a big retail store, you know, they have the winterized chamber, right? So before you had the big double doors that would slide, a lot of times there would, and in a smaller facility, you have an outside door that you have to open and an inside door that you have to open. And if you're walking with somebody, the first person opens the first door, the second person goes through and opens the second door, and then right?
And you punched a hole.
Everyone does that. Automatic. Well, there are people who don't understand it. I mean, there are people who do that wrong, and what they cause is traffic jams with people flowing through these little doors. So you don't see this as much anymore because everybody's modified their stores, and stores are bigger, and they're all automatic. But in the old days, almost everyone understood this kind of naturally because you do it a few times, and someone shows you how to do it. They don't have to talk about it; they just do it, and then you realize, oh, this is the right way to go through a set of double doors when you're walking with someone. So the double door protocol was the thing that really got me thinking about it when I was young.
But an API gateway is a revolving door. Never creates the air.
Different
metaphor. You see it go in, you see it come out. There's a request and a response, and you never pass through. Yeah. Another topic for another day.
It's basically an automation of the double door protocol there, right?
It's an iterative design process.
Well, and it is, right? Because basically with the double door protocol, you start with a design that's optimized in a certain way. It's optimized to prevent the winter air from coming all the way inside.
My new agile drawing, instead of the unicycle, bicycle and tandem, you know, single door, double door, revolving door.
Exactly. Because what you're doing there with the revolving door is you're stepping back and you're rethinking the assumptions. And it's like, oh, well, why are we putting the burden of having to understand how to go through these doors onto the people? And so that you change it to a revolving door. Also, you get more throughput. And of course, everything in the software world eventually comes down to, oh my God, what if 100 million people do this at the same time?
Yeah.
And sometimes they do.
That's when you need an air curtain.
Yeah, right. Like it reminds me of like Star Wars is full of these, right? Like you've got these giant ships and they have ships coming in and out of the giant ships. And you're inside a pressurized volume and the ship can go through and there's a big hole in the wall. How does that happen? It's magic, but
it's fiction. And that's actually another topic, which is the whole idea of the difference between you know, the dreams, visions, and plans. You know, you have to have vision, you have to know where you're going, but, you know, you usually start with the dream, and dreams are, of course, very fuzzy, that lead you to vision, which is where you start turning it into something you can actually do, but it's still not executable until you get to executable business strategy. You know, and a lot of times we start developing things while we're still in the dream stage. And we really need to work our way through to actually get a strategy. And again, that's why I'm kind of trying to figure out a better framework for being able to say, start here, do this, you know, let's get the who, then let's get the what, then we can work on the how and the where.
Well, as you work on this, let's stay in touch, because I think down the road we'll talk about it again.
Yeah, definitely. Always good to talk to someone about it, just because it helps focus things for myself as well. So, because I hope it wasn't too rambly today.
I don't know. That's for the audience to tell us.
All right.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Have a good day.